Our main speaker for this evening, Kim R.
That's called a bunny dip.
No, I'm kidding. Hi, my name's Kim and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Larry for having me come speak tonight. And I want to thank Michelle for giving him my name. And I was told to share in a general way. And I can tell you that for a little over 24 years, I have not been that general. So I don't know that I can do that tonight, but I will do the best I can. I want to thank Michelle and Cheryl for meeting me for dinner tonight and some good conversation and good fellowship. And my friend Susie for being here with her guy Pat. I just feel really, really feel really loved tonight. I feel really cared for tonight. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't feel that way. Before I get started, I had a nickname, and it was like Dirty Whore, so I'm not really sure who wins in that one. And my life is really full because my divorce will be final on July 15th, so my wedding anniversary was June 8th. It is now, divorced July 15th. So thank you, Judge. I love that man. So here's what I can tell you. I can tell you that my parents worked really hard and tried very hard to make me a decent human being. My parents tried to teach me everything that they knew about life and what was right and wrong and choices and good choices and bad choices and being a moral individual and having an ethical compass. And my parents were not bad people. My parents had problems. I don't know whose parents didn't. I mean, my father was a product of the Depression and my mother was the product of an alcoholic family. So both of them were only children. I think my father suffered. I think this is totally my opinion. It has not based in anything except articles that I read. But I think my father was somewhere on the Asperger spectrum. He was a mechanical engineer, and his entire life was you could filter it down to measure twice, cut once. And I'm the kind of person who goes to Home Depot and goes, "Yeah, that'll fit." And that is like the basis for the conflict I had with my father my entire life. He was Mr. Cautious. He was measure twice, cut once. And I was, just do it. It's going to be okay, I'm sure. And then it's not. And I'm like, but I didn't know. And he couldn't figure that out. He was like, but usually when people do something and it turns out badly, the next time it comes up, they look at it and go, maybe I shouldn't do that. And I'm like, no, because this time it'll be different. And that was before I ever took a drink, right? This time it'll be different. And so I had two parents, both only children, found each other. I don't know how that happens. Two only children find each other. And, you know, all of a sudden they have children and there's a universe and it's not them, right? And with only children, I'm sorry if you're an only child. I'm just going to say this. They had a hard time with the concept of sharing. And that was really their biggest problem. I mean, you know, my parents didn't drink. My father, I love this about my dad. My dad would buy beer in bottles, and then he would get these rubber plungers. They would look like angel wings on the side, and they had a head, and you push the head in, and it opened up the plunger part, and you put it in the bottle. You would release the head, and it would make a seal into the bottle. And so basically my father would buy beer by the bottle so that he could have, on a Saturday morning after he had finished his chores for Saturday, which were mowing this enormous lawn, and then because he refused to install a sprinkler system because he could do it better, he had a sprinkler that he would move every 10 minutes around this lawn. He would set the time every 10 minutes. He did this for 35 years. 35 years. Yeah, I know. At 12:30, he would make himself a salami sandwich on rye, and he would pour himself half a beer. And he would sit down and he would eat that sandwich and he would drink that half a beer and he would put the plunger back into the bottle and put the bottle into the refrigerator for tomorrow. And then on Sunday, when he finished his morning chores on Sunday, whatever they happened to be, whatever it was that the kids broke that he needed to fix, right? Because that was his nickname. Oh, you break, I fix. That's his nickname. He would then sit down, have another salami sandwich, this time on pumpernickel, with the other half a beer. And that's how my dad drank my entire life. And it frustrated the hell out of me. Even before I knew what beer did, I knew it had to be good because you couldn't drink it if you were a kid. And anything that you can't drink if you're a kid or eat, it's got to be good. And then when I was drinking, I was like, who the fuck does that? Who does that? That's like crazy. But you know what? He did that with everything. Like he would get a Hershey bar and it would last him 6 months. I know, these are my people, you understand. Who does that? And my mother didn't drink because her father was an alcoholic, and she was pretty convinced that if anybody had to drink more than once a month, you were alcoholic. It didn't matter. There was no rationale. There was no excuse. If you drank, had more than one drink a month, you must be an alcoholic. She couldn't drink wine because it gave her a migraine, so she stopped. Yeah, well, it makes me, right, a dirty whore. So and that didn't stop me. So I don't get it. And now she's, you know, she's 78 years old and she has a vodka gimlet on her birthday. That's what she does. So that's the family I grew up in. I have an older sister. I love my siblings. I have an older sister. She's 9 years older than me. She went to college. She graduated. I went to college. I failed out. She graduated college. She went and got a master's degree. She succeeded. She got married. She had two kids. She went and got her PhD with two kids. And now she's a tenured professor at Duke. Who does that? Who does that? She owns her home. She owns every car she's ever driven. She's never not had a driver's license, to the best of my knowledge. She's always had insurance. It's always been registered. And my brother's the same way. My brother works for Wells Fargo. He was at Wachovia Financial when they got bought by Wells Fargo in that, you know, well, let's not call it a depression. We'll just call it a recession. But he got bought up, and they offered him a job, and he moved to St. Louis, and now he lives in St. Louis, and he got married in October to a lovely young woman who's also in finance, and they're just financial, and they own things. And I ask you the question, I guess the same question all the time, who does that? I don't understand. I am 45 years old. I have almost $200,000 of student loan debt. Yeah. I was unemployed for 7 years. Talk about it's going to get taken away. 7 years. I've worked since I was 13 years old. I have always had a job. And in 2007, I didn't know it. I feel like that part in Bill's story where he talks about we had known that it would be my last day of honest work for the next 10 years. If I had known that September 27th of 2007 was going to be the last day that I was going to be employed for 7 years, I don't know that I would have stayed sober if I had known. Because I didn't have much going into it. I had gone to grad school. I had a lot of student loans. But I had at least the idea that I was a contributing member of society and I could have a job and I could show up to my job and people thought I did good work and they wanted to hire me and they wanted me around. And I lost it. I lost that feeling. I also got married to a man who clearly didn't want to be married. And I stayed with him for 5.5 years. And I didn't lose that marriage. What I lost was the part of me that believed that I was lovable. That's what I lost. And that's with time. That's with time. So my parents tried to teach me everything, and I didn't want to learn it because I thought I knew better. Because I'm an asshole. And I'm a bratty kid, and I know better. And so my father would say to me, you want all the responsibility. He'd say to me, you want all the freedom and none of the responsibility, but what you don't understand is that with freedom comes responsibility. And I would think to him, you are an idiot. You don't know. It is entirely possible. I'm 17. Right? 17. It's entirely possible to live without responsibility and total freedom. right? Janis Joplin says it. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. If I have nothing left to lose, I'm totally free. So I barely made it out of high school. But I started drinking at like 14. I stole vodka from my parents' liquor cabinet. It was like the only bottle of vodka they had. It was left over from my bat mitzvah. I'm Jewish. I was told Jews can't be alcoholics. So I held on to that for a little while. We can. Just letting you know. I've met a few. I grew up in Los Angeles, which is a hellhole of a city. And I love it. I mean, I do. I love it. Parts of it, anyway. And I grew up, so I started drinking at like 14, and I found the bars on Sunset Boulevard at 15. It's 1985, and boys with long hair are in bands riding Harleys. And I found heaven. You know, when I was a kid, I had one hero, and it was Pinky Tuscadero. Pinky Tuscadero. I was not a Wonder Woman fan. I couldn't give a shit about the first, you know, Supreme Court justice. Pinky Tuscadero. She had her own motorcycle, and she, like, she came in and out of Fonzie's life. He didn't come in and out of hers. That's all I'm saying. And she was cool. And so I don't, well, yeah, you guys know who she, okay. So, okay, yeah, hell yeah. She was awesome. So that's who I wanted to be. And when I found boys with long hair on Harleys who played in bands, I found heaven. I found, like, I had this dream that I was going to marry one of them, or not marry, whatever, and I was going to go off and have their rock and roll babies and drive off into the rock and roll sunset on a tour bus. That was my dream, and that, that didn't happen. I dated guys who had long hair and were in bands, and they all lived in a one-bedroom apartment, usually on Franklin Avenue. And they all their band equipment in the living room and mattresses on the floor, and between them, they had one job. Because the rest of the time, they were going to make it. and we would go to Sunset Boulevard and pass out flyers and then go to the gigs because, you know, you had to pay to play. And I loved it. It was great. And I drank my way through it. And I'm a bar drinker. I'm an underage bar drinker. But, you know, when you go to the DMV and you say, hi, my name is Debbie Young, and I lost my driver's license, and here's my, this. It's 1986, right? So how hard is that? They're not checking. They took my thumbprint. Whatever. The library has my thumbprint, whatever. And I got a driver's license that said I was old enough to drink, and so I drank, and I went to the bars, and, you know, by the time I was 18 years old, I was spending every weekend doing what I knew. I love drinking. If you're new tonight and you're like, ah, fuck, I love drinking, I get it. I loved it. It was awesome. I walked around all day, every day, feeling awful. I felt like I didn't fit in. I felt like you knew I didn't fit in. I felt like, and you knew it enough that you didn't even want me around, but you were too polite to say anything. And so it was only a matter of time before you finally got so fed up with me. You said, you know what, you have to freaking go. You have to go. And so I lived with this fear all the time that you were going to shun me or leave me or ditch me or just not invite me, because that happens too. And then also that I'm just different and weird. And when I was a kid, I really believed this. I really did. I would read. I was an avid reader. I read all the time. And I read science fiction, fantasy. I'm a total nerd. And I would read these books, and I was convinced that, you know what, they left me behind when they left the planet. And they were going to come back and get me. And I was just waiting for my day when my people were going to come and get me, and you were all going to see that I just wasn't from here, and that was the problem. And then I found alcohol, and it didn't matter. Alcohol was awesome. I took a drink, so here's what would happen. And it's only in hindsight, right? I mean, I don't know this while I'm drinking. I just know I'm drinking, and I feel better, and I want to continue to feel better, so I'm going to continue drinking. I know in hindsight that if I took a drink, what would happen was it would sever or shut off or dampen that part of my brain that told me all the time that I wasn't enough or good enough or smart enough or pretty enough or fast enough or witty enough or funny enough, all those things I'm just not enough of. It would shut that off, and I could go and be with you until I had enough alcohol that I no longer needed you. And then that was magic, because I was like a self-contained entertainment unit. It was me, and that's all I needed. And you were always looking for me. Where the hell did Kim go? Right? I was the girl that you went out with, right? And then you were like, well, we can't leave. We can't find Kim. That was me. And then I'd show up the next day, oh, I'm totally fine. Where were you? I don't know. I'm fine. Don't worry about it. But it's not. I'm not fine because, you know, I when I drink, I need to feel better, again, still. And the other way I feel better is men. Men make me feel better about myself. So I find them. They may belong to you. They may not. I don't know. Never asked. They never offer to, you know, tell me one way or the other. And that's how I drink. I drink in bars, and I go home with men I don't know. And it's by the grace of whatever higher power exists out in that world that I'm not dead. And my father would be angry, and he would be afraid. This is what I know today. He would be afraid for me, and his fear would turn to anger because he didn't know how to just say, I'm afraid for you. He would just get angry. And so we had a lot of fights in our house. I went off to college in Arizona, and I failed out. That's what happens when you drink and you don't go to class, just by the way. If you're in college and you think, I can do this and stuff, I would say 80% of the battle is going to class. Like, you could drink and go to college, and if I just went to class, I probably would have gotten a C, and I wouldn't have failed out, but I couldn't even get to class. I literally, this is not a joke, this is not an exaggeration, this is not because it's like the power of a good story, I literally walked in the middle of my psych final. The middle, and I'm like looking around going, why is everybody taking a test? I could not remember that it was the final. So I clearly failed the class. So this whole time from the age of 14, I'm seeing shrinks and I'm not seeing shrinks and taking a trip and not taking a trip, right? And then I fail out of school and I come home and my father wants to know what I'm going to do. It's the next day. I've just gone, what are you going to do with your life? And I'm thinking to myself, that's a lot of question for 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't know how to answer that question. And I had taken speed so that I could stay up during our six-hour car ride from Tempe to Los Angeles. I had taken a couple of back beauties. And I'm an alcoholic. I drank. I love alcohol. But I was also an underage drinker. And there's something that happens with a drug dealer. They don't ask for ID. So if I don't have my ID, they've never said, oh, can I see? They don't really want to know my name. So it's all good. I also had a friend who worked in a pharmacy, and she was selling, we were stealing drugs out of the narcotics locker. So that was easy and cheap. I've never had a lot of money, so whatever's easy and cheap, that's my middle name. That's not my nickname, that's my middle name. So I'm high and I'm telling my dad I have all these plans when I get home, and it's a 6-hour ride. There's a lot of plans to talk about in 6 hours. He has no idea I'm high. He can't even fathom this. This is like not even, my father is so far removed from this world. He thinks I'm serious. And he thinks I mean it. And so he wants to know, what am I going to do about all these plans I told him? And I have no recollection of telling him any plans because that was the fastest car ride I was ever in. And so I'm like, I don't know, Dad. And he's like, but you had all these plans. And it's true, I did, and I don't know what they were. And that's how I was. And to the outside normal observer, it looks a little bit like I'm uncaring and callous, mean, selfish, a little stupid, possibly mentally compromised. And I really think my dad was like, he really had no clue what he was dealing with. He thought he was just dealing with bad decision making. And he didn't realize he was dealing with an alcoholic. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And I went off to France. I didn't have money. I tried to become a prostitute through an escort service. I didn't pass the test. I had a tattoo. They didn't hire me. I don't know. My mother asked me once if I was going to get it removed because, you know, Jews, we don't like those tattoos. And I said no, and she didn't know why, and I couldn't explain to her that it probably saved my life. Because that escort agency, they were charging $600 an hour, and the girls were making half, and it was a two-hour minimum. I could have made $600 a night at the age of 18. It's a lot of freaking money to do what I was already doing for a couple of Quaaludes and a beer. I don't know. Seemed like a pretty good deal to me. As a matter of fact, I was going to go to Paris, and I thought, well, franchise. We're going to franchise. I'll open the first Paris franchise where prostitution's legal. So they didn't hire me. And I went off to France, and I became a nanny. I don't even mean for that segue to be funny, but it really, it's so sad, it's funny. I became a nanny. I took care of somebody's 4.5-year-old twin girls. And so at this point, I'm drinking every night, and I'm on Prozac because my shrink thinks I'm depressed, so I'm on Prozac. And I'm snorting heroin every day and taking care of somebody's children. And this is my job. My entire job is to get up at some point and be at their school at 4 o'clock when they get out of school in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walk them home, hopefully in one piece, play with them, give them dinner, get them a bath, get them ready for bed because the parents come home at 7 to eat dinner and they want to spend time with their kids. That, my entire job is like a 3.5-hour chunk of time in the afternoon and then all day on Wednesdays because the little kids in France don't go to school on Wednesdays. That's my entire job. And I can't get to that school on time to save my life. I know. It's sad because those kids are sitting there waiting for me and they don't know why I'm not there. And I don't have children. I've not had my own children, but I took care of somebody else's children, and I did what alcoholic parents do. I left my kid at school because I couldn't get there. For whatever reason, I couldn't get there. And when I got sober, my sponsor said to me, I don't know how, she goes, "You at this point, I really don't know how you're going to make an amends to that family. You can write them a letter, and that's one thing. Clearly, you can't, at this point, there's no way to do it face-to-face, and probably you shouldn't because they're probably glad you're not there anymore. She said, but you're going to treat everybody's child like a newcomer, and you're going to be the smiling face they see when they walk through that door. And that's what I have been for 24 years. And people's kids love me, and I take care of people's kids until recently. And their kids love me. And I feel like I have been able to, it's not really an amends to those kids because those kids are 30 years old now, right? Something like that, 28. It's really that I'm just trying to, like, create a spiritual right where there was a spiritual wrong. It's kind of it. And so I feel like my slate is a little bit cleaner. So I lost that job because I quit. I thought it was because I got fired. I didn't get fired. They wrote me a letter. They said, if you can't follow our rules, you can't stay under our roof. I thought they were firing me simply because I cannot follow your rules. That's impossible. So I must go, you know. And so I did. And I moved in with my alcoholic boyfriend. And we had an alcoholic relationship until I came home and got the chicken pox. That's how I came home because I had the chicken pox. I had nowhere to stay, nobody to... I had no health insurance in France. So there was nowhere to go. And so my mother brought me home, and I got sick, and then I got better, and I went out drinking. And February 21st, I had a plane ticket to go back to Paris, and my shrink had told me I should probably try AA. And that was really February 21st, that was my choice. I could get back. I could get on that TWA flight to Paris and go back to that alcoholic relationship or go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could not make that decision to save my life. This is what February 21st looked like. 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to Paris. 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm not. 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to Paris. 11 o'clock in the morning, I'm not. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I call my mother at work. I'm taking the flight. She's like, I don't effing care what you do. She goes, I'm at work. You'll have to take a cab. I have no money, so I'm not going to Paris. Seconds and inches, really. Really just being broke. Like, thank God, I was broke. And so I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. It was a Tuesday, and I went to Tuesday Night Ohio Street in Los Angeles, which for some of you who know, and now those of you who don't, it's a Pacific Group meeting. I have no idea what the Pacific Group was. I just thought AA was AA. I called a guy I had dated briefly. I don't know. It's not really dating, but... And he had been sober at some point when I met him, and then I called him, and... He was clearly no longer sober because he was taking bong hits, and he said, oh, he was looking in his meeting directory, and he goes, oh, there's a meeting on Ohio Street at 7:30 to tonight. Fine. I know where Ohio Street is because I had gone to a shrink right across the street from there for 5 years. 5 years. My high school was down the street. I would walk to her office. I would sit with her for 50 minutes, tell her about how horrible my parents were, no solution to that because I can't change them, right? I can only change me. But she's not telling me I can't change them. She's just saying, tell me more, And how do you feel about that? How does that make you feel? And I'm thinking, well, now I'm just going to tell her everything because clearly there's no repercussion here, which is new to me because there was a repercussion for everything. So I was just telling her, you know, well, and then I had sex with this guy and then I went home with that and then I did this and then I stole that and then and she says, and how does that make you feel? And I have nothing against, I'll tell you what, I have sought outside help in the time I've been sober. But for my alcoholism, for active alcoholism, it was not her help that I needed because it was not her help that I could use. It just wasn't going to help me. It was one alcoholic talking to another, and I didn't know that because I didn't know I was alcoholic. And so I went to this meeting, and I walked in the back door. I wore what I think is my most professional outfit at the time. And they knew I was new, and I didn't know how. So my outfit was, it was a black micro mini skirt, it was fishnet stockings, it was 5-inch fuck me heels, it was a leather, I mean it was 1991, so it was a leather bustier and this little purple jacket that had like one strategic button right here, and I had a hat, and that's not even the best part. The hat had a birdcage veil. And I smoked. So, right? Like here? That was me. And I walk through the back door and they go, oh, you're new. And I'm like, how the fuck do you know that? Like, I could have 20 years of sobriety. I mean, I get I'm only 21 years old, but I could. How do you know? And I'm like, now I know. So if, yeah, so we know. We know if you're new. It's okay. And I took the 20 questions and I got 17 out of 20, right? And the woman who gave me the questions, she was this cute, short, I mean, of all the things, right? I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and I think, well, I can't really be alcoholic. I'm Jewish. And what do I meet? A short Jewish lady. Harriet. She was adorable. She had the biggest smile of anybody I know, the happiest person I'd ever met in my entire life. And she said, sit next to me. And I did. And, you know, that was not my sobriety date. I was pretty sure I was a drug addict and not an alcoholic, and so if I just didn't do any drugs, I would be okay, because alcohol's not my problem. Alcohol's not my problem. So I spent the next, like, I don't know, 6 weeks going to meetings and leaving and drinking. And I went to a meeting every night, so clearly I drank every night, because I would leave the meeting and go and drink. And April 6th, I went out with some people to celebrate my 21st birthday, turning 21 the next day, and that was my last drink. It was a gin and tonic at a bar called Small's, and I only drank half of it. I couldn't finish it, and I got really sick that night in a way I hadn't gotten sick before. And as far as I know, that was my last drink, and so my sobriety date is April 7th of 1991. And I would love to tell you that I have spent the last however many years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing everything fantastically perfect, and I'm really spiritual, and I have it all figured out, and I just do the right thing all the time, and I never make a wrong decision, because that would be awesome, and it's a lie. It would be a total lie. It would be horrible. I got sober. I went to meetings. I got a commitment at every meeting, as you do in the Pacific Group, because that's what we do. Get a commitment at every meeting. They don't tell you that the commitment's going to last a year, yeah. Right? I think it's like a month, right? They're like, no, it's a year. The secretaryship just turned over. Like, oh my God, I don't know where I'm going to be in a year. They're like, oh, that's okay. We know where you'll be in a year. I'm thinking I'm going to go through these steps. I'm going to go through them really, really fast. And when I fast, I mean like in a month. I'm going to get very spiritual. I'm going to learn it all. And then I'm going to go take that spirituality and go and drink spiritually back in Paris, because I'm going to go back to that guy. And then I forgot that was my plan. I thank God every day that I forgot that was my plan. I got so busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even remember I had a plan. And, you know, the thing about that home group is that it is what they like to refer to as a river of enthusiasm. The thing about it is that, you know, it's kind of awesome to be new and be swept up in a river of enthusiasm. Because I don't know enough to say no. They said, do you play softball? I said, no. They were like, you do now. I'm all, okay. I mean, I thought I had to play softball to go to meetings. I didn't know that you didn't. They just, you're on the stepsisters. Oh, okay. What do? Show up at 7:30 at 1212 Lake Street. We play across the street. I'm like, okay, I've never played softball in my life. That's okay. We have plenty of mitts. Why would I do this? It's just so dumb. This is horrible. I've never played sports in my life. I ran cross country for like a semester. This is awful, but I did it. At about 2 years of sobriety, I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up falling madly in love with that man. And the problem for me was that he had a wife, and he stayed with her for the next 10 years that I was with him. So if you're new, so here's what I can tell you for me that I know, is that I can withstand an immense amount of spiritual pain and sobriety. I can. It's unfortunate. Less so now than I could then, because my road is narrowed. I was told that I could do anything I wanted in sobriety, and it's true. I can do whatever I want in sobriety. I really can. I can go to grad school, or I can rob a bank. I can become a lawyer, or I can go hook out on the street. Doesn't matter. I can do whatever I want in Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing is there's a price for everything I do. And I don't know what that price is. That's been my biggest lesson in sobriety. I don't know what my price is. I don't know what it's going to cost me down the line. And that affair cost me a lot after the fact. I don't know what it, I didn't know what it was costing me at the time. But after the fact, it cost me a lot. It cost, you know, we talk about in order to feel self-esteem and self-worth, we do esteemable acts in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard that a lot when I was new. I don't hear it so much lately. But doing that was not an esteemable act, and therefore my ability to regain some of that self-respect and self-esteem that I lost when I was out there was compromised, and I didn't get it back for a very, very long time until after that affair was over. That man died a couple months ago. Here's the other tab I had to pick up for that. I was a secret. And if I'm a secret in life, I'm a secret in death. And so it was like I never existed in his life, except for a few people who acknowledged it. I was like I never existed. And it broke my heart. Because that was 10 years of my life. I went back to school in sobriety. I graduated college. I went to law school. I failed out. I thought I was special and different. I'm not. Who knew? And so I tried again. I got into law school here in San Diego, and I came down here. I went to law school. I graduated. My dad was at my graduation. And here's what I can tell you, and it's kind of this strange series of events that have occurred over the years, but they seem to have come into this singularity. I don't know how else to describe it, but it's like this sphere of all these things are in it together. When I was about 3 years sober, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who I was very close to. And we were talking about my father, and he and I had a horrible fight. I was sober. I thought, we shouldn't be fighting. I'm sober. This is ridiculous. This is stupid. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm still not that bright, but I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not out there, you know. And she said to me, just think about this. She goes, your father, when you were born and he held you in his arms for the first time, what did you think he thought? And I said to her, I don't know. And she's like, no, seriously, think about it. If you were a parent and you had your child in your arms for your first time, what would you think? And I said, well, I think I would say, I love you and I want you to be happy and healthy. Like, that's what I think I would say. She's like, do you think that's what he said? And I said, yeah, probably. And she goes, so do you think that when he finds your bras tucked under the seat or your pantyhose or tights on the walkway from the car to the house, do you think all those times that you came in at 4 o'clock in the morning drunk with your mascara all over your face, do you think that's what he thought happy and healthy looked like? And I said, well, no. And she said, it's just something to think about. And from that day forward, I never left the house, no matter how bad the fight was, without saying I love you to my dad. Never did. Not once. I said I love you every time I left the house. Every time I called the house, that's what I said. It didn't matter if he was being completely irrational. I learned that when he'd asked me if I had air in my tires or if I had changed my oil, that's how he said I love you back. You taught me that. The men in Alcoholics Anonymous, the fathers in Alcoholics Anonymous, taught me that's what that meant. I didn't know that's what that meant. I thought he was telling me I was irresponsible and that I needed to take care of my shit. And so this woman who I had this conversation with, we had this friendship, and then this friendship fell apart, and we had a huge screaming match at our meeting on a Wednesday night. And it was a horrible screaming match. 1,000 people heard it because it's the big meeting. And I said things to her that were horrible, and she said them back, and it was Heather. And not a Heather in this meeting. No, it's another. Just somebody here knows her. We didn't talk for years and years and years. And about 4 years ago, through the magic of Facebook, we reconnected in a very kind of minimal way, but we reconnected and we had some nice conversations and some nice chats. In the meantime, my father and I, we have this relationship and it's developed and grown and I love him. And he got cancer in 2007, at the end of 2000, he got diagnosed at the beginning of 2008, the year I got engaged, I was going to get married. My dad is sick. And it turns out he's dying, and I am now not working, right, as I told you. And so I'm going up to L.A. all the time to take him to doctor's appointments. And he and I are fine. We're fine because of what you taught me here to be a good daughter. I didn't know what a good daughter looked like. A good daughter says I love you when you leave the house. He came to me at my law school graduation, found me in line, and he said to me, I just wanted to say to you before your mother gets here. It's always, everything was before your mother gets here. He said, I just wanted to say to you that I'm proud of you and I love you and I know you're going to be okay because you did this and you have that A&A thing. I don't know what it is, but it seems to help. He would give me a cake every year at my Saturday night meeting in LA and he would laugh and I was like, oh, he's laughing. That's kind of bad. I don't know. For the man who controls his drinking that way, I don't know how good that is. But anyway, and he loved it. He loved you guys. He thought you guys were great. You took good care of his little girl, and he was happy with that. And he came. So he said this to me in line, and he said, and I just want you to know I'm proud of you. And fast forward, I'm this 2008. He's sick. We have this wonderful relationship now. It's fine. And I get married because I'm telling myself that the way my father... So I believe as an alcoholic, I tell myself stories. We call it lying, but I call it storytelling. I tell myself stories. And these stories, they have plots. They have rationales. It's like John Steinbeck is writing them. They're awesome. They have no basis in reality. So this is the story I told myself. I'm marrying a man that I don't really think is the right man to marry, but I'm marrying him because that way my father will know that I'm okay. And he'll walk me down the aisle before he dies. That's the story I told myself. And I just told you that he found me in line to tell me 4 years prior that he was proud of me. But I forgot. And so I went through with this wedding and I married this man and, you know, it wasn't good. And a month later, my dad went to the hospital right after the wedding, literally 2 days later, and he died a month later on July 10th. And we buried him on July 13th. And then I spent the next 5.5 years saying, but you know what? My dad was at my wedding. My dad was at my wedding. So I spent 5.5 years in this marriage, and sometimes it's really hard to say I made a mistake, right? I mean, I'm sober. Like, I'm sober not 5 days. I'm sober some amount of time. And now I have to admit that I made this mistake. And I'm pretty sure there are people out there going, yeah, you did, and we told you it was a mistake, and they're waiting for me. Like they're waiting to say, see, we told you so. And that alone is keeping me kind of in it, because I'm like, well, I'm not going to give them the satisfaction of being right. And I'm unemployed, and I can't get a job, and my self-esteem is just taking hit after hit after hit. But at the same time, I'm doing things I never would have done. You know, I'm volunteering outside of Alcoholics Anonymous and organizations that I really believe in. And I'm getting up and I'm applying for a job every day, day in and day out. And I'm living my life outside of this marriage because he doesn't want to live it with me. And I started to go to Al-Anon. And for all of you in here who think as alcoholics, oh, those Al-Anons, I got to tell you, they got something on us. They got something on us. And you know what I realize it is that they've got on us? It's that they understand, and now I understand, that sometimes I need to admit I made a mistake. And I need to reset. I need to do something different, restart, do something else, get out of it. And it took a lot for me to get to that place. And I found out that, you know, here's karma for you. I spent 10 years with a married man. And I found out that my husband cheated 3 times. And it was the 3rd time that got me to the place where I decided the marriage needed to end. And it was 1 year later that he moved out. And I filed for divorce in December of this year. And so my divorce will be final July 15th of this year. And I'm really grateful. I'm really grateful. So this little story about this woman I got in this fight with, right? So I get, and we start to, and then my mom has surgery 1.5 years ago. She has bladder cancer. They take out her bladder. She's cancer-free. It's all good. She has no bladder, but she's got no cancer. And this woman is helping me. She's, like, showing up for me. She's meeting me at meetings, and we're having conversations, and we had, like, a real amends. Not just a, I'm so sorry I did that, and I'm sorry I hurt you, and but we had a real conversation about what happened and about our feelings. And it has been so hard for me in my lifetime to acknowledge that you've hurt my feelings. I would rather just get angry. I just would rather get angry. If I get angry, then I'm a tough bitch. I'm not an overly sensitive alcoholic who's afraid to get her heart broken. This woman broke my heart, right, in our friendship. So I said this to her, and we had a great conversation. 2 months ago, she got a new job, and she posted that she needed a manager. And I said to her, well, I'll keep an eye out for you. I'm a recruiter. I'll keep an eye out for you, see if I can find one. 1 week later, she posts again, I really need a manager. I don't know what the hell to do. There's so much work going on. I write back, jokingly, oh, if only I knew anything about marketing, I would apply. She private messages me, and she says, I don't give a crap that you don't know anything about marketing. I know you, I like you, I trust you, and I know you'll do a good job. Send me your resume. I started working for her May 4th up in Los Angeles. I am now a legal marketer. I don't know crap about marketing. I don't know the first thing about, I know ROI. That's what I know. I went to law school, I could not pass the bar. I sat for the California State Bar Exam 6 times. I know defeat. I know what it is to get to log on and not see your name. I know about disappointment. If you're here tonight and you're new or you're not new, you've been around a while and just the shit is not falling into place, like it's not, I get it. I get it. I lost my dad. My mom had back surgery. She had bladder surgery. I couldn't get a job for 7 years. I failed the bar exam 6 times. I wanted kids that I never had because I had a husband who didn't want to be one. I get it, but I also get that the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, gives me the chance for a life I never dreamed of. Here's the beauty of all of that. I got to live my life regardless. I would go and meet my friends at Fiesta Island with our dogs regardless. I would go hiking regardless, go to the zoo regardless. Go live my life and be happy regardless of what was laying on my couch day after day, unwilling to get up. Regardless of the fact that my mother was sitting in a hospital room having to, at 77 years old, figure out how to use an ostomy bag. 77, having to figure this out. I can't even imagine. I can barely figure out my phone, right? And she's got to put an ostomy bag on. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me in my entire life. And I'm not saying that in hyperbole. I am saying that because I know that without Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think I'd be dead. I don't know that I'd be dead. I would be a really pitiful human being. I've seen what my life would be like. The year after I got sober was the LA riots. And I went to go see a friend of mine who I had been drinking with, who I hadn't seen in a little over 1 year, and it was the weekend of the riots. There was a curfew in place, and I drove to her place. It was after a wedding. I drove to her place, and I saw the inside of her house. They had gone looting, and the inside of her house was filled with cases of booze, baby clothes for babies they didn't have, stereo equipment. She was harboring a fugitive and a stolen car in the garage, and that's who I drank with. So do I think that, like, that there was a party to be had? No, I'm just that pathetic woman at the end of the bar. I'm 45 years old now. I am not cute and young. I was cute and young. I am now 45 years old. But I am 45 years old, sober 24 of those years. If I had kept drinking, that's who I'm, that pathetic woman at the end of the bar, hoping against hope that somebody will buy me a drink because I can't afford to buy my own. And that would be the pathetic end of my existence. So if you're new tonight, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care how old you are or young you are. It doesn't matter. I got here at 21. I never had a legal drink in my life, ever. I took a lot of painkillers for anticipatory emotional pain. That's what I called it, anticipatory emotional pain. I knew I was going to have it, and I just was going to keep it from coming. And for 24 plus years, I haven't had to do that. And I have been able to show up for family and friends and repair relationships both in sobriety and outside of sobriety. And I have been able to be a good human being for the most part out in the world. I pay my taxes. Even though I didn't work, right? How the hell? No job. I pay my taxes. So I just want to say thank you, and I want to welcome you if you're new. I hope you stay. There's a lot of people here who want to help you and see you stay sober. Thanks.